We all want a business like Netflix or Amazon Prime. Businesses where once a customer engages with them, it becomes automatic and a part of their lifestyle from then on. But how do you build that forever transaction? I'm Robbie Kelman Baxter, and I have been studying subscription and membership models for nearly 20 years. In this podcast, my guests and I share the secrets and strategies of the membership economy. Join us for Subscription Stories, True Tales from the Trenches. Something I've noticed over the years is that there's a natural membership economy mindset among many family-owned businesses and organizations not on the venture-backed IPO acquisition path. Companies that aren't on a tight timeline to an exit have the ability to invest in long-term trusted relationships with customers and with employees. After a career as both a founder of multiple successful companies and a venture investor with Kleiner Perkins, Dave Wharton decided he wanted to work specifically with what he came to call evergreen leaders, the ones who combine sound business principles, extraordinary purpose, and a desire to share their success with their employees. His Tugboat Institute researches these organizations to identify best practices, and then he brings together these leaders to teach and support one another. And now he's written a book, Another Way: Building Companies That Last and Last and Last. It's a playbook for entrepreneurs seeking an alternate path to success. In my conversation with Dave, we discuss how venture capital has changed the face of entrepreneurship and what it means for founders, the seven P's that are the guiding principles of evergreen companies, and the two key constituencies that matter most to your organization's long-term success. Dave, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks, Robbie.
So tell me a little about yourself and how you came to found the Tugboat Institute.
Yeah, so my background is I've actually had a few jobs in venture capital, and I've started three companies, one nonprofit, so four total. And I have always been looking to kind of find those entrepreneurs that are very similar to Dave and Bill of Hewlett-Packard, Dave Packard and Bill Hewitt. I had the good fortune of working with them in high school and college, working for their company, not for them directly. I'm just exposed to them. And I love their values. I love the HP way. And I found over time, I kept kind of going back to that touchstone of how they treated people, how they built great products, how they engaged their communities. And I really admired that. And so I found, much lengthier explanation in the book Another Way, but I found in kind of the 2010-2011 timeframe coming out of the Great Recession that I just wasn't being exposed to people like that in my very early stage venture capital investing. Smart people, capable people, ambitious people, but there was a real orientation around wealth generation at a level I had not seen when I first got involved in Silicon Valley. And there's some other things happening behavioral that just caused me to believe it just didn't feel the same as what I'd first been exposed to in technology. And so I went on a learning journey to see if I could identify the next generation of Dave and Bills. And in the process of doing that, it was very slow because you can imagine I'm turning to a lot of friends in Silicon Valley saying, who do you know that's ambitious to build a big, meaningful company, wants to do it right, but has no interest in raising venture capital, private equity, and no interest in ever being sold or going public? And I got a lot of blank stares initially. Like, what? That doesn't even make sense. You can't tie together big, impactful company with somebody who's not raising capital. It doesn't work. But as I got through that, we can talk about that more later, I started meeting these folks. And I met a number of people around the country that were doing this, both founders and multi-generational family businesses that were ambitious, important, meaningful companies, but doing with really good values. And through that process, a number of them said, hey, look, if you're meeting other people who are thinking the way I'm thinking, and are aligned with these values, I sure would like to meet them. So I made some one-on-one introductions, and pretty soon I'd heard it enough that I decided, why not invite a group of these folks to get together and talk about this and share ideas and best practices and celebrate? And I had a second home in Sun Valley, Idaho, and I thought that'd be a great place to kind of gather people. So we did that in October of 2013. I had the first gathering. It was about 40 people, CEOs and leaders of what I came to call evergreen companies. And within 24 hours, I knew this is what I wanted to do. I knew this, I was on the right path to finding the Dave and Bills through this kind of company. And so that was the beginning of Tugboat Institute.
And just to make sure I understand, were you doing this as a gift to the world, or was there a business in bringing them together? What was sort of the motivator to do this?
Well, at first it was to see, was there any role for me to play in serving them? And I wasn't sure. I mean, I didn't know a lot about the way they built businesses or bootstrap businesses. These are multi-generational businesses. And so it was really in that first 24 hours where I had a lot of people get up on stage. I adopted kind of the TED style. I've been a TED since the late 1990s. Get up there, 20-minute talk, no Q&A, and just share an idea that you shared with me with the rest of the group. And then we'll talk about these over lunch and hikes around the mountains and whatever else we were doing that afternoon. And I saw very quickly that, yeah, there was an opportunity to be of service to them, that this sharing of best practices, this kind of giving them an opportunity to connect and inspire each other was pretty powerful. I didn't know exactly what the business model would be. It ended up being a membership model, which is pretty appropriate for your show. And for good reasons, we can talk more about. But yes, there was a, first I had to see if there was really a need. And then second was, could I actually design a business model that made this make sense for me?
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up the membership model around the Institute, because I think that's quite interesting. But the original reason that I really wanted to have you on the show is because a lot of the principles that Evergreen companies use that you've so beautifully defined and framed and illustrated, a lot of those principles are very similar to the principles of the best membership economy companies. And a mutual friend of ours pointed that out to me several years ago. And since then, I've been avidly following what you're doing at the Institute. But I'm interested in why it was so hard to find these people at first. What has happened in Silicon Valley that makes it not so fun to be like David Bell?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think that there's founders who would not like to be like Dave and Bill, right? I think that, you know, it's aspirational. I mean, they're two incredible human beings. Great book, The HP Way, about them. But I think the game as it's played today is one that's very much about raising capital. And I think it starts in your first conversation with an angel investor. It starts in conversation with your lawyer. I mean, things are so geared in Silicon Valley to, hey, look, if you want to build something of significance, you're just going to have to go raise money. So the angels start talking about this. Your lawyer starts talking about this. Your neighbors start talking about it. And pretty soon, for almost everybody, it's the de facto path. There is no other path. Remember one time I had a conversation with an attorney. I said, look, in practice, do you incorporate companies first as LLCs or C-Corps? And he said, well, C-Corps. And I said, well, why not LLCs? I mean, they're actually more beneficial for the entrepreneur if they're not going to raise venture capital. It's a tax advantage status, because if they're going to distribute cash, it doesn't get our dividends. It's not going to be taxed twice. LLCs do not tax twice. They tax once, where C-Corps would tax twice. And it was like, what are you talking about, Dave? I said, so you don't even think about this. You don't even have a conversation. This is a very successful Silicon Valley attorney, about which path you want to take. And he says, no, I mean, it's obvious. The path to take is going to be to raise money from the best venture capital firm you can. So I think that's what made it so challenging, because posing this question, who do you know is ambitious to build a meaningful company who has not raised venture capital or private equity? For many people, that's a null set. There is nobody they know, because the entire ecosystem in Silicon Valley and more broadly is geared towards that pathway.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's become the de facto standard because there are so many celebrated successes along that pathway. Google, Amazon, Juniper Networks, you name it, Facebook, LinkedIn. And those are the stories you get told, right? And as anybody knows who studied venture capital knows that that is a very rare occurrence to have companies that exit at those levels or become public at those levels. There's a very much a power law dynamic in the venture industry. And so half or more of most VCs portfolio companies actually don't even return capital. They just get shut down or they don't survive an extra round of financing. And it's only a few percent that actually end up having a meaningful return. So that's what's exciting. That's what's accelerated. It's a lot more interesting, I think, to put on the front page of Inc. magazine, Elizabeth Holmes, when she was considered the next Steve Jobs and worth $1 billion, then put on the cover myself or Jessica Herron to talk about Evergreen companies, which is exactly what happened with Inc. magazine in October 2015. They swapped out a cover photo that was really celebrating this idea of Evergreen companies. It was written by Bo Burlingham, a co-author of Another Way. And they decided, no, there's this woman and she wears all black outfits and she's a cute blonde girl and she's going to revolutionize blood testing and she's worth $1 billion. Well, 3 weeks later, the Wall Street Journal broke this, that this was this was a fraud and she's in jail today. But there's just something exciting about the coming from nowhere, hugely successful, get rich, and all the people getting rich along the way. And very little have talked about the very high failure rate and what that experience feels like. But no, I don't know why it's become so dominant. I mean, it is so dominant. But I can tell maybe from personal experience, there was a few family businesses. My business school class at Stanford Business School, graduated 1997 as the dot-com boom was taking off. And we largely were not interested in them. We were really interested in what was happening in venture capital, what was happening in with dot-com, with e-commerce. We're reading the Red Herring magazine, which was celebrating all of this. But it is where we are. And I think it's very unfortunate because I think venture capital is very appropriate for some businesses, particularly businesses that have very large upfront capital expenditures. But for the vast majority of businesses, doing something evergreen will lead to a much higher likelihood of having a successful company for that founder than going for that rocket fuel and trying to get escape velocity.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that you make, that it's going to be a much more successful outcome for the entrepreneur, which I think is really key to this, thinking about why you get into an entrepreneurial venture in the first place is often to build something lasting and meaningful and that makes an impact. And to me, at least, as someone who's grew up here in Silicon Valley, been here almost my whole life, the imagined outcome of being the next Google feels very vivid and very real. But the reality for so many founders is you give up a lot of control when you take the venture money, and the expectations are to hit certain metrics in the short term, which may potentially impact you in the long term or potentially impact your ability to build out the vision that inspired you in the first place.
A nuanced point, but with the size of most venture capital funds today, for them to return that fund and have a good profit on it, let's say do somewhere between 3 and 5 times return of the initial capital, they need really big exits. So they're gunning hard for having things that are going to become really big. And again, it's a path for some that's very appropriate, still very risky. But for the vast majority, building something more slowly, building it from your own fuel, could give you an opportunity to build something still very significant. But it'll be done over a longer period of time. It won't be done in 5 or 10 years, but it could be done within your lifetime. You could build something from 0 to $1 billion in revenue in your lifetime on a self-funded basis, you know, with the right market opportunity, with the right business model, with the right team. It's very, very doable. We have examples of that.
Yeah, I would love to break down some examples of what you've alluded a couple times to an evergreen company. What is an evergreen company? What makes it different from a deciduous company? What makes it different from the venture-backed companies?
Good clarification to ask for. So when I was meeting with these different companies, I was meeting family-owned businesses. I was meeting employee-owned businesses. I was referred to foundation-owned businesses, partnerships, a variety of different ownership types. And so what I realized is there wasn't really a name for this type of company that could be one of those ownership types, but with this core value system. And so that's what came with Evergreen. I kind of socialized it with some of the early people I was interviewing with, and they were like, hey, that's a cool name. It has a good connotation. There's a significance to it. There's a pacing of growth to it. There's a resilience to it. There's a kind of majesty to it and an elegance. But after we had our first event, my colleague, Chris Ald, made a very astute point. He said, we've got to be careful about this because we're going to put a lot of effort into building this idea of evergreen companies, and we should trademark it. And we've done all those things you can imagine. But he said, we really need a framework, and for two reasons. One, so that we really are the people who define what it means to be an evergreen company. So as we invest all of this energy in building this community and these ideas, that somebody can't co-op us, you know, particularly who is worried about a private equity firm, for example, starting to say that, you know, perhaps, you know, their companies were evergreen companies. And then in addition to that, he said, it's also a flag in the ground. So people know that if they do operate consistent with these values today, they're a good candidate for being part of our membership organization. So I came up with 7 P's to define this, and I presented it to the group back in 2014, so pretty soon after we incorporated Tugboat Institute. And it's purpose, perseverance, people first, private profit, paced growth, and pragmatic innovation. And the idea being is that if you continue to mature on each of those 7 P's, and as a system, strike a balance between those P's, because there are in some cases some trade-offs, you have a much higher probability of being around 100 years from now than if you're work with some other value system. And what's been so rewarding is I put that out to the community back then, and I said, look, this is really a straw man. It was a concept I learned at Bain & Company. It was a hypothesis. And I said, I want you to poke holes in this. Is this right? Is it wrong? Am I missing something? Is there too much in this? And here we are, it's 12 years later, and it's as strong as ever. And I continue to get incredible satisfaction when I meet particularly multi-generational family businesses that have been around for 100, 150, 200 years. And I'm like, you know what? That's a very good framework for how we think about how we run our business. And so it gets validated over and over again. And so not to say that it's not, you know, there aren't other things you shouldn't be concerned about. It doesn't mean companies can't have their own specific value system and how they want to interact and operate with each other. But that these seven are very resonant with the community and people who see themselves as evergreen companies.
Can you share an example of an evergreen company that we might know?
Well, fun one I think we all experienced when we were younger is Radio Flyer. So the Red Wagon Company, that's a third generation company founded by Antonio Passon 100 years ago. And today it's run by his grandson, Robert Passon, and run very successfully. Incredible people first culture, very committed to staying private for generations, profitable, growing consistently, very innovative. I spent some time with them and some other members at their headquarters just outside of Chicago. And it was really fun to see how they innovate. I mean, they're a case study in what IDEO would teach you about experimentation. I think Robert calls it planting lots of seeds and planting them early and finding out what takes and then really investing behind those. Because you don't have the luxury in an evergreen company to go raise $20 million and burn it on product design to have something come out that doesn't work. You have a company and it's profitable and you want to steward that successfully and you want to grow it. So you get very, very creative about reducing risk around innovation in a way that's more consistent with how venture capital was practiced 30 years ago than we see today.
Yeah, it's so interesting, this very long-term vision, this willingness to experiment and iterate, and this idea of kind of continuous small improvement.
It's part of that. So there's an element of pragmatic innovation, which is what you call Kaizen. It's continuous improvement, so well exampled in the Toyota production system. But there's also invention. So I've had some really interesting conversations with Clayton Christensen before he passed away about how, because evergreen companies can take very long planning horizons, very long investment horizons, it doesn't mean they don't have to be disciplined about getting to early profitability, either on the company or on a future product line. There's an important discipline to be, as he would say to me, be impatient for profits, but patient for growth. He said, Silicon Valley is the opposite. You guys are impatient for growth, but too patient for profits. And with that mindset, you can actually develop something over a period of time, enter a niche market, validate the technology in that niche market, make it better, make it stronger, and then move upstream to more mainstream markets over time or expand the greenfield market you're in very successfully. So I don't want people to think evergreen companies are, they're just companies that are in kind of unsexy industries where they're kind of getting a little bit better every day. Yeah, they're doing that. But there's moments of, in some of these companies, incredible invention. Some of these companies have really sophisticated M&A capabilities for buying companies and successfully integrating them. I mean, look at Enterprise Rental Car. That's an evergreen company. Andy Taylor very successfully bought National and Alamo and did something that I don't think most strategic buyers or private equity firms would do, is he bought them and he left them alone. Because he realized through the due diligence process, they were both well-run companies and they actually had different customers. Well, same cars, they had different customers and customer profiles. And so he did take Stubblefield and put him in over the two companies to make sure that they adopted the enterprise system and values and things, but they didn't fundamentally change them. I mean, the playbook would have been normally, if we had back in business school, right, Robbie, would have been, hey, you bought National, you bought Alamo, roll them into enterprise, rebrand all of them, and then they become enterprise. And he was smart enough to realize is that there are different travel segments, and let's make sure we address those well. So I just say that because sometimes I get that from people. I said, oh, these are probably sleepy companies. I'm like, oh, no. Don't underestimate these companies. And they don't, they will typically innovate where they see really clear opportunity versus being highly speculative. I see that as kind of a discipline. But again, that was a discipline that was quite normal back in Silicon Valley. I mean, this highly speculative stuff people do with lots of money really comes down to how effectively the founder can sell capital providers on their idea. He doesn't have to sell customers, or she. She has to sell funders. And that's a really interesting orientation where your business early days are either rooted in the foundations of serving customers well and getting to early profitability, or they're in how do I raise continuous rounds of funding to continue staying in business and fake it until I make it. It's a very different type of foundation to be building from.
Right. I mean, and I think the customer centricity of these evergreen businesses is what, you know, one of the things that sort of resonated with me when I think about membership businesses in a membership economy company, you know, and I've talked about this a lot, that people always ask, are you work on subscriptions? And I say, well, mostly there's subscriptions involved, but a membership economy company, they're focused on the customer relationship and they're looking for a business where they have an ongoing relationship with the customer and they follow the customer to innovation.
I love that. That's absolutely perfect.
Yeah. And that we've had several guests on the podcast who I think really fit your definition of an evergreen company. One that comes to mind is Hagerty, originally an insurance company, now increasingly a lifestyle brand around classic cars.
I wish they stayed private.
Yes, for another discussion. But for many years, a private company closely held run by McKeel Hagerty, son of the founders. And another one that is really interesting to me and kind of close by is Blue Diamond Almonds.
Oh, interesting. I enjoy their products, but I don't know them well. So
they are delicious, but they're a co-op.
No, co-op. Yeah. And co-ops can be evergreen companies. We have several in our group that are evergreen.
And they said, our goal is to protect the integrity of the almond growers.
That's great.
We're not just focused on making more money. We're focused on quality product and a business in the next generation.
Yeah, that's great.
And it's that kind of different mindset that it requires a longer runway, which I know is something that you talked about.
Forever runway, ideally.
Yeah, exactly. But it also, you said evergreen companies have the benefit of time,
yeah,
right? They also have the challenge of time, right? Mm-hmm. They have to be patient in many cases, but it does pay off. It's a more solid foundation from which to grow, I think.
That's what we believe, and that's what I see. And think about some of the dynamics around this. If you raise a lot of capital, you're expected to grow very fast. You want to get to hundreds of millions in revenue in a 6 to 7 year period. The company is probably more than doubling every year. So that means you're probably more than doubling your employee base every year. Think about the strain on the culture, the training, the assimilation, the onboarding. And so a lot of these companies actually end up culturally having weak foundations because there's so many new people all the time that it overwhelms. And it's very hard for the young founder and leader to continue adapting and learning to keep up with that pace. In the context of an evergreen company, if you're targeting, I'm going to run this for the rest of my life and I'm looking to build something of scale, you might be very comfortable growing it at 15 to 20% a year. And same type of thing, if your employee base is increasing by 50 to 20% a year, you can very easily assimilate those people, train them, onboard them, guide them. You can develop your first line managers. As everybody knows, and Tom Peters has talked about over and over again, the entire employee experience is most affected by the first line managers. In rapidly growing companies, first line managers are promoted often with no training at all. It's just they've been there longer. And so it's, now it's time for you. Whereas in evergreen companies, they can be extremely deliberate. There's one called McCarthy out of Dallas. And that one, the CEO is involved in first line manager training because he says it's so important to get them off on the right footing as early managers and then develop them over time as leaders. And so the pacing of growth creates a lot of room for building your culture, developing your team. And very importantly, and very selfishly, if you're a founder, and I've been a founder, it gives you room to grow yourself. And it gives you breathing room to get better and better because we all start with only so much experience, no matter where you came from. Frankly, we all started with no experience if you go all the way back. But it's really wonderful to see CEOs that are able to go on what I like to call learning journeys. They're now at $50 million in revenue. The wheels are shaking a little bit. They're not sure they got the right management team. Maybe they're having to revise and kind of tweak their business model. And they're like, you know, I got to go talk to other really smart people. I'm going to spend the next year going out meeting with people and sharing ideas and seeing what I can bring back to the group. And then coming back with some really good fundamental insights to take the company to the next 100 or 200 million in revenue. No venture-backed CEO has the luxury of that. Spend a year. Can you imagine explaining that?
You can't even take
that?
A week.
Or a weekend. You can't even take a weekend.
Right.
So, anyway,
right.
You get the idea. Pace growth is pretty powerful.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things I want to highlight that you just said that I think are really relevant for our audience. One of them is if you're an entrepreneur, building a business or you're thinking about launching a business, this is another path you can take, which number one, I think you've made a case for building a lasting, profitable business, but also you only get one life. And having an opportunity to do the work that you want to do, continue to learn and grow, and have the power to create and support meaningful work for the people on your team has a value that some of us might think exceeds the value of having a...
I think most evergreens feel that way, which is they look at the employee experience as being a really important part of their contribution over their lifetimes. And they're very proud of that. High net promoter scores, people going home at night, happy to see their families, not completely exhausted, not looking working long hours. Those same people, well-trained, they can actually serve on nonprofit boards in the community. They can do other things to positively impact the experience of other people that they care about in their broader communities. That's pretty important stuff. And also being able to retire comfortably, maybe not getting a big IPO exit, millions of dollars, which happens to very few. Keep in mind, so many fail. But in this case, I see tremendous generosity by the owners of these evergreen companies that if somebody spends their career with them, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, they often retire very comfortably with millions and millions of dollars in retirement, which you don't see if people are changing jobs every 4 or 5 years, you know, and if they're in a situation where either there's not great compensation or they never get the brass ring because they never end up one of the lucky ones that got one of the big exits. So I do want to say one thing you remind me of too, is that what I love about the evergreen path is there's no financial gatekeepers. If you're going to raise venture capital, you have angels, you have VCs, you got to have the right VCs. You have to have VCs round after round. And so there's this constant gatekeeping on whether you're doing well or not. And it's how they perceive you and the board perceives you versus how the customer sees you or the employees see you. Maybe a little bit the customers, right? But not really the employees. Just unfortunately, I think that's the case. In an evergreen company, you really have two constituent groups you're very focused on, particularly early, and you maintain this forever, which is, do you have happy customers and do you have happy employees? And if you can satisfy those two conditions, you will likely have profits, unless you have a really silly business model, but you have a thoughtful business model, you will generate profits with those two happy groups, and you can become self-sustaining very early. And funny enough, the person that shared this with such simplicity with me was Andy Taylor of Enterprise. He said that was kind of what got them off the ground. You know, his father, Jack, started the firm was just, Jack was focused on, I want happy customers and happy employees, and I think it's all going to work out fine. That's a $35 billion revenue company today. That's never, I guess it raised a little bit of outside capital, but the family that gave it to him decades and decades ago wanted out. So unfortunately for them, they got out. But yeah, and that's what I love. So if you're sitting anywhere in the country, and you're like, well, I just don't have access to those angels. I don't have access to the venture capital community. Maybe I'm in an underserved group, a minority group or women or whatever it may be. Well, I say go evergreen and build that yourself from a strong foundation. And I would love to see lots of minorities feel empowered to build evergreen companies. Or if they have a company to say, oh, wow, I didn't realize there was this path. I can now build something of significance. I had an interesting conversation with a leader in the Black community in Chicago about this. And he said, gosh, I really would love to see more people not be afraid to go the distance. And his observation was that often in the communities he's in, if somebody starts having some real success, they're convinced to sell the company and capture the wealth because they say so few get that, you don't want it to disappear on you. I'd love for it to be opposite, which is helping create the courage to go the distance. So, you know, maybe some of those people start building companies that are doing billions in revenue and owning them themselves and their family owning them. I think that would be an incredible thing. But again, I love this idea. The gatekeepers to an evergreen company are your customers, your employees. The gatekeepers on the venture path is the next round of financing. Who are those people going to be?
And your book, which I have to just take a moment to remind our listeners of, that is coming out in May of this year, 2025.
May 6th.
Building Companies That Last and Last and Last Another Way. You'll recognize the cover because it has an evergreen tree on it, which is, it's actually a beautiful cover.
Thank you.
And I guess the book plus the Institute are your ways of spreading what you've learned, what you've seen, and providing some pattern recognition to those entrepreneurs who maybe didn't have the benefit of working directly with you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I've got really two parts to the vision for Tugboat Institute that I formed pretty early. And the first part was to build a membership organization where we were an unparalleled resource to support them. and doing that through curating the best ideas and practices within the community with the rest of the community. And then bringing thought leaders in from the outside, folks like you, Robbie, Tom Peters, General McChrystal, Susan Cain, people like that who have a really clear point of view on things that are very much aligned with being an evergreen company. So we also bring those insights into the community. But the second part, and I wasn't able really to work on this as much as I liked until our first decade was completed. We're now up to about 300 CEO members. It's a really robust, wonderful community. But now we're trying to get the word out so that this can be the insights, the best practices can be enjoyed by anybody, anywhere in the country, if not around the world. And we do that. The book is a very important piece of this. We have a subscription newsletter, the EJ Plus, which has a very low price point, but gives access to all of our articles, all of our videos, over 500 articles and videos around best practices of evergreen companies. And we even created a little assessment tool that people can do. They can go online, spend about an hour entering information about their company and their financials and their people first policies and how they're structured from a private standpoint. And then we give them a report back that shows how they're doing on each of their 7 P's kind of directionally. Gives them 5 ideas on how they could further mature the company against these evergreen values. And then we just give them 30 or 40 best practices. And my hope is that, you know, for small business owners in particular that are kind of aspiring towards this, they can kind of see where they are and maybe see where there might be some opportunities. Because I think most people, when exposed to good ideas they've never heard before, they get it pretty quickly. Like, oh, I didn't know that was possible. Because I keep hearing about, because a lot of the practices we hear about are about public companies and venture-backed companies. And some private equity companies. You rarely hear about the practice of these wonderful evergreen companies. And we just want to, in the second part of my vision for this, really share that generously. Again, well beyond our borders. I hope people can enjoy this throughout the world.
Yeah, it's very, very generous of you to pull all of this together and to make it available for the cost of a book or the cost of a low price subscription, as well as having the more kind of real time in person benefits of the Institute and your events.
And I'd say this, Robbie, too, with all humility, it's really the generosity of the members. The fact that they're willing to share the ideas. This was really, I got to give Chrissy Anderson credit for this, because when he took over the TED conference, I was part of it when it was a secret conference. Not secret, but you very hard to attend, about 350, 400 people. All the talks were confidential. They gave DVDs afterwards to the attendees and said, please don't share these with anybody. And Chris, when he bought it, he said, look, these ideas are too important. Why wouldn't we want to share these with the world? And so he really inspired me on this too, which was, I'm going to ask upfront and very early, can we share these ideas beyond our walls? And there was an enthusiastic support for this by the members. And that continues through today. I mean, our ideas come from them.
Yeah, it's interesting. Something that I've found with membership organizations, particularly around professional development, business-oriented communities and membership groups, is that people often come for the content and stay for the people.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Finding like-minded people is a very powerful thing. You know, this concept of mirroring neurons, I heard about this many years ago, and it really struck me is that kind of the people you surround yourself with will reinforce subconsciously how you behave yourself. So if you're really focused on good diet and your people around you are, that just gets reinforced. If you're really focused on exercise, they'll be reinforced. It's very rare to have somebody who's in a group of non-exerciser who's a really passionate exerciser, because it's part of our socialization process. We mirror kind of the behaviors of the people we surround ourselves with. So membership organizations are really important in that dimension, in my mind. Very important to Tugboat Institute, because as they're running around the world, not just in Silicon Valley and other places, they will hear over and over again, why aren't you selling your company? Why aren't you diversifying your wealth? You're taking too much risk. You've got single company, you have sophisticated financial terms. And you then gather with 300 others that say, well, yeah, I could diversify wealth, but then what do I have? I just have money. And I have an account with Morgan Stanley, and they're putting me in a bunch of investments. I know I'd rather reinvest in my business. I have a purpose that matters greatly to me and my family or the other owners. So yeah, that community portion is extremely important.
Yeah. And I think a couple of things to say. One of them is, I think especially, you know, you and I are around the same era of business school and around the same age that one would be if one graduated from business school in the mid-90s. And I think I find as I get older, purpose matters more. It becomes increasingly important, and having meaning and having a reason to get up in the morning and something that you're excited to do and something that you're excited to learn about and get better at and be more impactful with, becomes increasingly important. And I think, you know, when I think about the Institute and the community, and I'm guessing and hoping that you're going to have something for your readers to also connect with each other, whether it's through that the EJ subscription or whether it's through some other kinds of more scalable programming.
We're all ears on that, just so you know, Robbie. I mean, I hope it's through the EJ Plus, the Evergreen Journal Plus subscription. But if there's more we can do, we listen. And to your point about listen to your customers, and we're extending ourselves into serving those customers. And it could be gatherings around that too. And I don't want to get ahead of things, but we're here ultimately to serve.
But it's a combination. I think it's a combination of bringing the people together, but also the umbrella. So like you said, it's not just that all of these Evergreen entrepreneurs, business owners are gathering, because what sometimes happens is you gather. They might all be gathered somewhere, but they don't have the framework to have the right conversations. So I think that's a really important part. And even having something as simple as a book club around another way, it gets people talking about things that they might not have ever shared. And not that they're secret, but just that they haven't made it to the level of consciousness of what they're trying to do, why it's meaningful to them, why they've shied away from diversifying themselves into a more secure financial picture. So anyway, I think that's really important and really admirable. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. And you said something earlier I want to bring back up. You have one life to live. And if you are so fortunate at some point in your life to identify something you could really get behind and focus on for decades, it could be in a nonprofit, could be in a for-profit, could be in almost any domain, the arts. But specific to what I evangelize, if you figure out that there's kind of a customer base you would love to serve for the rest of your life, this is a great way to do it. Because I think the most heartbreaking thing I've seen over and over again is somebody who starts with that in mind, raises outside funding, and then is in a position where their company is either sold or very rarely taken public today, but primarily sold. And just a few years later, that dream is over. That company has not operated the way they wanted, but they had no control over it. They had taken the capital. At some point, the investors needed an exit. And I call these the heartbreaking moments, because you're finally getting to a point where it's all working. You may be growing nicely. You finally got the right management team. You really understand your markets. Your development teams are working well. And you get the knock on the door and two board members walk in and say, you know, it's time. It's time to hire the bankers and let's get the process going. And that's when the dream is over in many cases.
So much more that I know we could cover that I would love to talk about with you, but hopefully we'll save that if you're willing to come back. Right. We'll save it for a future conversation. But I'm wondering if before you go, if you have time for a speed round.
Sure. I'm here for you, Robbie.
All right. First subscription you remember having?
Highlights Magazine.
Me too.
Who's a member of Tugboat Institute now. Talk about full circle.
Oh,
for
no
me.
Kidding.
Yep. Love Kent Johnson. Love Highlights.
Oh, wow. I loved Highlights. Did not know it was an Evergreen company. Your favorite subscription now?
You know, if I'm being honest, it's probably the Wall Street Journal, because I do read that every day. So,
most impactful business book you've read this year or ever, your choice?
Ever would be In Search of Excellence by Tom Peters. I read that when I was at Berkeley as an undergrad, and that book I still have today. It's dog-eared, but it's what inspired me not to go into engineering, but to go into business and strategy.
And one membership or subscription business that you think we should know about?
Well, the one that I modeled Tugboat Institute off of is the advisory board.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I really like the idea. Frank Williams, who's a good friend of mine from Bain & Company, was the CEO, but I met him, talked about the advisory board when he was an executive. And I love this idea that they got paid up front by, I think at the time, 2,200 medical professionals or organizations, asked them what they wanted advisory board to do research on over the course of the year, then played back that research to the group. I'm like, this is amazing. And they get their revenues up front. They know exactly what they can spend over the course of the year, how much they can grow. I thought that is a powerful model.
Yeah, that's a great story. I got to get them on the podcast.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thank you so much for being a guest on Subscription Stories. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Robbie. I enjoyed being here with you.
That was Dave Wharton, founder of the Tugboat Institute and the author of Another Way, Building Companies That Last and Last and Last. For more about Dave and the Tugboat Institute, go to tugboatinstitute.com. And for more about Subscription Stories, go to www.robbiekelmanbaxter.com/podcast. Also, I have a favor to ask. If you liked what you heard, please take a minute to go to Apple Podcasts or Apple iTunes and leave a review. Mention Dave and this episode if you especially enjoyed it. Reviews are how listeners find our podcast, and we appreciate each one. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening to Subscription Stories.